Hello, and thank you for joining us for today's episode. If you know a fascinating case you want us to cover on Into the Killing, we'd love to hear from you. We especially love cases that don't get much attention from other podcasts, YouTube channels, and the mainstream media. To suggest the case, please go to criminallylisted.com and click on the Suggest a Case page. You can also suggest cases for our YouTube channels, Criminally Listed and Paranormally Listed. Just fill out the questionnaire on the website. Before today's video, we want to give you a warning. It's not like the rest of our episodes are exactly uplifting. After all, this is a true crime podcast. But today's cases are considerably more depressing than many of our other episodes. Hopefully, that doesn't scare off too many of you, and you'll find the cases interesting. For the first case, we're going back to May 1997. On May 1st, 1997, Tony Blair was elected Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. The next day, a major scandal rocked Hollywood when Eddie Murphy was stopped by police for picking up a transsexual sex worker. On May 5th, after 11 seasons, the Fox sitcom Married with Children aired its finale. On May 6th, the NHL hockey team, the Hartford Whalers, became the Carolina Hurricanes. During their 18 seasons in the NHL, the Whalers didn't win a single Stanley Cup. The Hurricanes won the Stanley Cup in 2006. On May 10th, there was a 7.3 magnitude earthquake in eastern Iran. More than 1,500 people were killed and more than 2,300 people were injured. On May 14th, the number one movie was the Luc Besson-directed sci-fi action film The Fifth Element, starring Bruce Willis. The number one song in America was the hip-hop classic Hypnotize by the Notorious B.I.G. Midwest City is in central Oklahoma and is about 8 miles from downtown Oklahoma City. It's also home to the first ever Sam's Club store, which is Walmart's membership-only warehouse club. In 1997, it was home to about 53,000 people. That included 26-year-old Shannon McCrossin and her two daughters, 8-year-old Kirsten Hatfield and 3-year-old Faith McCrossin. Shannon gave birth to Kirsten when she was 18 years old. As a result, she didn't finish high school. Shannon and Kirsten's father briefly lived together. But things didn't work out, so Shannon moved in with her mother and stepfather. The three of them raised Kirsten for the first 4 years of her life. When Kirsten was four, Shannon felt ready to be a single mother, so they got an apartment. Shannon met a man, in December 1993, they were married. In 1994, she gave birth to Faith. Tragically, in the spring of that year, Shannon lost her mother to cancer. A year later, in May 1995, Shannon left her husband. Shannon had gotten her high school equivalency diploma, and she had taken some computer courses. She worked several jobs. In 1997, she worked at the Oklahoma Tax Commission. But she had a problem. Daycare was simply too expensive that it wasn't worth working. So she quit the week before Mother's Day. On Mother's Day weekend, 1997, Shannon took her two daughters to a friend's home in Stonewall, Oklahoma. They spent the weekend climbing trees and playing horseshoes. On May 12th, Shannon went to the Department of Human Services to see if she could get free daycare. She was turned down because she was unemployed. Kirsten was considered a good kid. She was in the second grade. She loved the outdoors, playing softball, and her family. She had one specific way of being disobedient. When she was told to clean her room, she wouldn't do it. Instead, she was just in the doorway of her bedroom. At about 11:30 p.m. on May 13, 1997, Shannon tucked 8-year-old Kirsten into bed with her 3-year-old sister, Faith. The girls always slept with the door open and the hall light on. After putting her eldest to bed, Shannon went to bed herself. Shannon heard some crying from the girl's room around 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning. Half asleep, she lumbered over to their bedroom and noticed the door was closed. She turned the knob and pushed the door open. But she didn't look in the room. Instead, she just went back to bed. A few hours later, at 6:30, Shannon went up to get Kirsten up. It was Friday, and she had to attend school. Faith was in bed, but 8-year-old Kirsten was gone. Shannon looked around the house and became more panicked with every second she couldn't find her 8-year-old daughter. She ended up calling the police. The police searched the house and discovered that the girl's bedroom window was closed, but it was unlocked. They found some blood on the windowsill. They also found Kirsten's underwear near the back fence of the property. There was blood on the underwear as well. Initially, the police thought that Kirsten might have run away. But they quickly dismissed that idea because of her age, the blood on the windowsill, and the underwear. One of the first suspects was Kirsten's father. In the years since he and Shannon split up, he denied being Kirsten's father. He was living in Texas when Kirsten went missing. He had an alibi, and he was eliminated as a suspect. The police looked at the other men Shannon had dated and eliminated them as suspects as well. Shannon was interviewed and admitted that she socially did drugs. Shannon's brother, Aaron Hatfield, also used drugs. Months before the kidnapping, Aaron had been released from jail for drug-related convictions. The police investigated the angle that Kirsten may have been sold for drugs. But they didn't find any evidence that pointed in that direction. The police spent a lot of time investigating Shannon to see if she had something to do with her daughter's disappearance. This frustrated Shannon because she knew she had nothing to do with Kirsten's disappearance, so she knew the police were wasting their time. Shannon relentlessly worked, trying to get word out about her daughter's disappearance. She constantly hung up posters and called businesses to see if they would hang up missing persons flyers in their businesses. She spent so much time working on her daughter's case that she couldn't work at another job. She ended up moving out of the house where Kirsten was kidnapped and moved in with her father. She was so focused on finding Kirsten that she, unfortunately, lost custody of her daughter Faith. Faith's biological father got custody of her. Shannon wasn't even allowed to contact Faith on the phone. DNA testing was done on the blood found on the windowsill and on the underwear. The problem was that DNA testing was limited at the time, so they couldn't even say for sure that the DNA on the underwear and the windowsill came from the same person. With the lack of leads, the case went cold. Shannon never lost hope that her daughter would come home. 2 years after Kirsten's disappearance, Shannon married a man named Chris Hazen. Shannon decided to turn her grief and pain into action. She got a degree in criminology and got a job with the Department of Corrections working with sex offenders. 18 years went by since Kirsten was kidnapped. Then in 2015, the case was reopened. Bill Clinton was president when Kirsten went missing. Then, it was 8 years of George W. Bush. In 2015, Democrat Barack Obama was president. Pierce Brosnan was James Bond in 1997's Tomorrow Never Dies. And in 2015, it was Daniel Craig in Spectre. Sheryl Crow sang the theme song for Tomorrow Never Dies, and Sam Smith sang Spectre's theme song. In 1997, the biggest movies of the year were Men in Black, The Lost World, Jurassic Park, and Liar Liar. 2015 Saw movies were Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. Number 2 was another Jurassic Park movie, Jurassic World. and the third was Avengers: Age of Ultron. The top three songs in 97 were You Were Meant For Me by Jewel, I'll Be Missing You by Puff Daddy and Faith Evans featuring 112, and Unbreak My Heart by Tony Braxton. While in 2015, the most popular songs were Uptown Funk by Mark Ronson featuring Bruno Mars, Thinking Out Loud by Ed Sheeran, and See You Again by Wiz Khalifa featuring Charlie Puth. When the case was reopened, the police realized that the DNA could be tested again. This time, they got a DNA profile and determined that the blood on the windowsill and the blood on the underwear came from the same man. But it was a mystery as to who that man was. There was no match in state or federal databases. The police decided to ask 10 plausible suspects to give a sample of their DNA voluntarily. If the men didn't give a sample of their DNA, then the police would have a good reason to be suspicious. The men gave a sample of their DNA and it was compared to the DNA found at the crime scene. On July 22, 2015, the police were shocked when the results came back with a match. It was the DNA of 56-year-old Anthony Joseph Palma. Palma lived two doors down from Shannon, Kirsten, and Faith. He had moved in the 18 years since the kidnapping. He was about 38 years old at the time of the kidnapping and had not been considered a person of interest. He came up in the investigation in 2015 because someone said he had done yard work for Shannon. The police interviewed Palma and he denied doing yard work for the family. He said that the police had interviewed him at the time and he allowed them to search his home. The police looked through the old case file and found no record of his house being searched. Palma was arrested on October 12, 2015. Anthony Palma went to trial 2 years later in October 2017. The trial lasted a week and the jury deliberated for an hour. He was found guilty of kidnapping and first-degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison. A month after the trial, Shannon said she had forgiven Palma. She even asked members of her church to write letters of forgiveness to Palma, and she planned on delivering them to him personally. But it's unknown if that ever happened. Shannon said she wrote three letters to Palma in prison, asking if he knew God and if he had a Bible. She claims she never asked anything about Kirsten. Palma wrote her back and told her to stop writing to him. Palma was incarcerated at the Oklahoma State Prison in McAllister. Palma's cellmate was 38-year-old Raymond Piatto. Piatto was doing a life sentence for three murders in Oklahoma County. On January 11, 2019, 59-year-old Anthony Palma was found dead in their cell. The cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head and ligature strangulation. Since Piatto was the only person in the cell with Palma, he was the sole suspect in the murder. The authorities did not give a motive, but they did say that inmates who victimize children can often be vulnerable targets in prison. It's unknown if Piatto was charged with Palma's murder or what happened to him after Palma's death. Some people thought that Shannon would be happy that the man who killed her daughter had been murdered himself. But she told the media she was not celebrating his death. She said she was praying for his family. A major problem for Shannon is that Palma had always maintained he was innocent. He never told the authorities what happened to Kirsten. So Shannon has no idea what happened to her daughter after she put her to bed that night. She may not want to know all the horrible details, but one thing she wants to know is the location of her daughter's remains. In February 2019, which would have been Kirsten's 30th birthday, Shannon released a YouTube video pleading for answers in her daughter's case. She said that she hopes Palma's death doesn't mean they'll never know what happened to her. Shannon and the rest of Kirsten's family hope that Palma confided in someone where he put the body, and it isn't a secret they took to his grave. If anyone has information regarding the whereabouts of Kirsten Hatfield's remains, they are highly encouraged to call the Midwest City Police Department or their local law enforcement agency. And now for our second case. Unfortunately, you'll probably notice the depressing similarities between the two cases pretty quickly. For this case, we're going to August 1984. That summer, the Olympics were held in Los Angeles, California. On August 3rd, Mary Lou Wren became a household name after becoming the first American woman to win the All-American gold medal. The big winner at the Games was American track and field star Carl Lewis, who won 4 gold medals. On August 11, 1984, Ronald Reagan was getting ready for his weekly radio address from his vacation home near Santa Barbara, California, while doing a soundtrack. While doing soundcheck, he said the following:
"My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes."
Reagan was, of course, joking, and the comments did not go live on the air. But they were later leaked to the public and caused a lot of headaches for the Gipper. The number one song on August 23, 1984 was the Ghostbusters theme song from the movie Ghostbusters. Perhaps, not incidentally, the number one movie in America was Ghostbusters. Fairfield, California is the midway point between Sacramento and San Francisco. It's home to the headquarters of Jelly Belly. In the mid-1980s, the population of the city was about 65,000. It was home to 3-year-old Clark Toshiro Honda. Clark was part of a large family. He had 6 half-siblings and 2 full-siblings. He was the youngest in his family. In July 1984, Clark's parents, Linda and Ronald, split up and Ronald moved out. On August 23, 1984, Clark went to bed in a bedroom on the main floor that he shared with his uncle and 4 other children. He was in a bunk bed next to a window. The next morning, at around 7 a.m., Clark's grandfather, Harry Smith Jr., looked in the room. He saw that Clark wasn't in bed and the bedroom window was open. Harry found Linda and asked her where Clark was. She assumed he was still in bed. They started looking for him and woke up everyone else in the house. Everyone looked for Harry, but he wasn't in the house or on the property. At 8:20 a.m., the police were called. A larger search of the neighborhood was conducted. Linda searched Clark's bed and found an envelope. Inside of it was a ransom note demanding $25,000. The ransom note stated that the money was to be dropped on August 24th at 9 p.m. He gave a location to bring the money. Clark's family did the best they could collecting the funds and followed the instructions on the note. They left the money as directed while the police and the FBI watched. But no one picked up the money. The authorities did not think that their presence spooked the person who was supposed to collect the money. They were not entirely convinced that the kidnapper planned on collecting the ransom money. Clark seemed like an odd choice to be kidnapped for a ransom. His family was not wealthy. Linda's oldest daughter said that most of the family members were poor. Also, the house they lived in was modest. If a kidnapper was looking to make some money and didn't know the family, they probably would have targeted a child who lived in a more expensive home. The police quickly eliminated Clark's parents, Linda and Ronald, as suspects. There was no physical evidence that connected them to the kidnapping. Also, both were incredibly active in the search for Clark. They both spoke to the media, begging for Clark to be returned safely. Sadly, that didn't happen. The family never heard from the kidnapper or kidnappers again. Days and then weeks pass. Time inevitably marched on, as it always does. Lurk's photos were printed on flyers and mail cartons over the years, but it never turned up any leads. One of the biggest problems for the police is that they didn't have any physical evidence. Someone had managed to sneak into the bedroom without waking the other five people in the room and carried the three-year-old off into the night. They didn't leave behind any hairs, fingerprints, blood, or any other type of bodily fluid. In 2011, the FBI and the Fairfield Police reopened the investigation. As we just mentioned, they didn't have much physical evidence to work with. But they did have a short list of suspects. All the suspects were interviewed again. Some of them were questioned repeatedly. One suspect stood out to them. His name was Michael Anthony Blas Faharan. When Clark went missing, Faharan was 23 years old and a friend of the family. He had dated one of Clark's half-sisters. Faharan stuck out to the investigators because, in 2002, he was convicted of 4 counts of child molestation. The crimes happened in 1981 and between 2001 and 2002. He was sentenced to 26 years to life. So the investigators visited him several times at the Valley State Prison in Chowchilla, California, where he was serving his sentence. The authorities noted that when he was asked about the night of Clark's kidnapping, his story kept changing. In 2016, the investigators questioned him again. This time, he confessed. He said that he and two accomplices, a man and a woman, were high on drugs, and they came up with a plan to kidnap Clark for money. Faharan and his two accomplices took him to a house in Vacaville, California, and held him hostage for a few days. Faharan said that during his captivity, Clark recognized him. He said, "Michael, why are you doing this to me?" Faharan admitted to killing the boy. But he claimed he didn't remember what he did with the body. In April 2016, Michael Faharan was charged with first-degree murder and kidnapping. In October 2017, 33 years after Clark Honda went missing, Michael Faharan pleaded no contest to first-degree murder. He had made a plea deal, and the prosecution dropped the kidnapping charge. He was sentenced to 25 years to life. The police have never identified Faharan's accomplices. The woman who helped him has died, so she will never be charged. The man has gone missing, and the police doubt that they will ever charge him. Clark's family still holds out hope that his remains will be found. The police believe that he might be buried on a hillside in Vacaville. Clark's father, Ronald, rode his bike past that area before being told his son's remains might be buried there. Now when he rides past the area, he can't help but wonder if he's riding past his son. The police and Clark's family hope that someone with information regarding his remains will contact the police. Clark's family understands that they'll never get him back alive, but they still want his remains so that he can rest in peace. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Please don't forget to check out our YouTube channels, Criminally Listed and Paranormally Listed. But that's all for today. Thank you again for listening. Please stay safe and take care of yourself.